Major Clive Mountjoy Standfast stared blankly at the map in front of him, trying to find some comfort. He was, tonight, the senior officer in the field. The commanders had gone to the palace for some party or other, and he was in charge. Vimes had conceded that the city's regiments had quite a few officers who weren't fools. Admittedly, they got fewer the higher you went, but by accident or design, every army needs, in key if unglamorous posts, men who can reason and make lists and arrange for provisions and baggage wagons, and in general have an attention span greater than a duck. It's their job to actually run things, leaving the commanding officer free to concentrate on higher matters. And the major was, indeed, not a fool, even though he looked like one. He was idealistic, and thought of his men as jolly good chaps, despite the occasional evidence to the contrary, and on the whole did the best he could with the moderate intelligence at his disposal. When he was a boy, he'd read books about great military campaigns, and visited the museums and looked with patriotic pride at the paintings of famous cavalry charges, last stands, and glorious victories. It had come as rather a shock when he later began to participate in some of these to find that the painters had unaccountably left out the intestines. Perhaps they just weren't very good at them. The major hated the map. It was the map of a city. A city wasn't a place for cavalry, for heaven's sake. Of course there had been casualties among the men. Three of them had been deaths. Even a cavalry helmet is not a lot of use against a ballistic cobblestone. And a trooper had been pulled off his horse in Dolly Sisters and, bluntly, mobbed to death. And that was tragic and terrible, and, unfortunately, inevitable, once fools had decided to use cavalry in a city with as many alleys as Ankh-Morpork. The major didn't think of his superiors as fools, of course, since it would follow that everyone who obeyed them were fools. He used the term unwise, and felt worried when he used it. As for the rest of the casualties, three of them had been men knocked senseless by riding into hanging shop signs while pursuing, well, people, when it came down to it, because with the smoke and darkness who could tell who the real enemy was? The idiots had apparently assumed that anyone running away was the enemy. And they'd been the luckier idiots, because men who rode their horses into dark alleys which twisted this way and that and got narrower and narrower, and then realised that it had all gone quiet and their horse couldn't turn round, well, they were men who learned how fast a man could run in cavalry boots. He totted up the reports. Broken bones, bruises, one man suffering from friendly stab by a comrade's sabre. He looked across the makeshift table at Captain Tom Wrangle of Lord Salarchi's Light Infantry, who glanced up from his own paperwork and gave him a weak smile. They'd been at school together, and Wrangle, the major knew, was a lot brighter than him.
"What'd it look like to you, Tom?"
said the major.
"We've lost nearly 80 men," said the captain.
"What? That's terrible."
"Oh, about 60 of them are deserters, as far as I can see. You tend to get that in this sort of mess. Some have probably just popped home to see dear old mum."
"Oh, deserters. We've had some of those, too. In the cavalry. What would you call a man who leaves his horse behind?"
"An infantryman. As for the rest, well, as far as I can see, only 6 or 7 of them went down to definite enemy action. 3 men got stabbed in alleyways, for example."
"Sounds like enemy action to me."
"Yes, Clive, but you were born in Querm."
"Only because my mother was visiting her aunt and the coach was late," said the major, going red. "If you cut me in half, you'd find Ankh-Morpork written on my heart."
"Really? Well, let's hope it doesn't come to that," said Tom. "Anyway, getting murdered in alleyways is just part of life in a big city."
"But they were armed men, swords, helmets."
"Valuable loot, Clive."
"But I thought the city watch took care of the gangs."
Tom looked at his friend over the top of his paperwork.
"Are you suggesting that we ask for police protection? Anyway, there isn't any, not any more. Some of the watchmen are with us, for what good they are, and the rest either got beaten up or ran away."
"More deserters?"
"Frankly, Clive, everyone's drifting away so fast by tomorrow we'll be feeling pretty lonely."
The men paused as a corporal brought in some more messages. They thumbed through them gloomily.
"Well, it's gone quiet anyway," said the major.
"Supper time," said the captain.
The major threw up his hands.
"This isn't war. A man throws a rock, walks round a corner, and he's an upstanding citizen again. There's no rules."
The captain nodded. Their training hadn't covered this sort of thing. They'd studied maps of campaigns with broad, sweeping plains and the occasional patch of high ground that had to be taken. Cities were to be laid siege to or defended. They weren't for fighting in. You couldn't see, you couldn't group, you couldn't manoeuvre, and you were always going to be up against people who knew the place like their own kitchen. And you definitely didn't want to fight an enemy that had no uniform.
"Where's your lordship?" said the captain.
"Gone to the ball, same as yours."
"And what were your orders, may I ask?" He told me to do whatever I considered necessary to carry out our original objectives.
Did he write that down?
No.
Pity. Neither did mine.
They looked at one another.
And then Wrangle said, Well, there's no actual unrest at the moment, as such. My father said all this happened in his time. He said it's best just to keep the lid on it. There's only a limited number of cobblestones, he said.
It's almost 10, said the Major. People will be going to bed soon, surely.
Their joint expression radiated the fervent hope that it had all calmed down. No one in their right mind wanted to be in a position where he was expected to do what he thought best.
Well, Clive, provided there's no...
the captain began. There was a commotion outside the tent, and then a man stepped inside. He was bloodstained and smoke-blackened, his face lined with pink where sweat had trickled through the dreadful grime. A crossbow was slung across his back, and he'd acquired a bandolier of knives. And he was mad. The Major recognised the look. The eyes were too bright, the grin too fixed.
"Ah, right," he said, and removed a large brass knuckle-duster from his right hand. "Sorry about your sentry, gentlemen, but he didn't want to let me in, even though I gave him the password. Are you in charge?"
"Who the hell are you?" said the Major, standing up.
The man seemed unimpressed.
"Carser. Sergeant Carser," he said.
"A sergeant? In that case you can—"
"From Cable Street,"
Carser added. Now the Major hesitated. Both the soldiers knew about the unmentionables, although, if asked, they probably wouldn't have been able to articulate exactly what it was they knew. Unmentionables worked in secret, behind the scenes. They were a lot more than just watchmen. They reported directly to the patrician. They had a lot of pull. You didn't mess with them. They were not people to cross. It didn't matter that this man was only a sergeant. He was an unmentionable. And what was worse, the Major realised that the creature could see what he was thinking and was enjoying the view.
"Yep," said Carser. "That's right, and it's lucky for you that I'm here, soldier boy."
"Soldier boy," thought the Major. And there were men listening who'd remember that. "Soldier boy."
"How so?"
he said.
"While you and your shiny soldiers have been prancing around chasing washerwomen," said Carser,
pulling up the tent's only vacant chair and sitting down,
"the real trouble's been happening down Treacle Mine Road. Do you know it?"
"What are you talking about? We haven't had any reports about any disturbances down there, man."
"Yeah, right. Don't you think that's strange?"
The Major hesitated. A vague memory bobbed at the back of his mind, and there was a grunt from the captain who pushed a piece of paper across to him. He glanced at it and recalled.
"One of my captains was down there this afternoon and said everything was under control," he said.
"Really? Whose control?"
said Carser. He leaned back in his chair and put his boots on the desk. The Major stared at them, but the boots showed no sign of embarrassment.
"Remove your feet from my desk," he said coldly.
Carser's eyes narrowed.
"You and whose army?"
he said.
"Mine, as a matter of fact."
The Major looked into Carser's eyes and wished he hadn't. Mad. He'd seen eyes like that on the battlefield. Very slowly, with exaggerated care, Carser swung his feet off the table. Then he pulled out a handkerchief, made grimy with unguessable humours, huffed theatrically on the wood, and polished it industriously.
"I do beg your pardon so very much," he said. "However, while you gentlemen have been keeping your desk nice and clean, a canker, as they say, is eating at the very heart of the city. Has anyone told you that the Cable Street watchhouse has been burned to the ground? With, we believe, the loss of the lives of poor Captain Swing and at least one of our technical people."
"Swing, begot," said Captain Wrangle. "That is what I said. All the scum your lads have been driving out of Dolly Sisters and all the other nests, well, they've ended up down there."
The Major looked at the report.
"But our patrol said that everything seemed to be in hand. The watch were very visible on the streets, and people were showing their flag and singing the national anthem," he said.
"There you are, then," said Carser. "Do you ever sing the national anthem in the street, Major?"
"Well, no."
"Who did his lordship set down there?" said Wrangle.
Major Mountjoy Standfast thumbed through his papers. His face fell.
"Rust," he said.
"Oh, dear, that's a blow." "I dare say the man is dead," said Carser,
and the Major tried not to look slightly more cheerful.
"The person in charge down there now calls himself Sergeant Keel, but he is an impostor. The real Keel is in the mortuary."
"How do you know all this?" said the Major.
"We, in the particulars, have ways of finding things out," said Carser.
"I've heard," murmured the captain.
"Martial law, gentlemen, means that the military comes to the aid of the civil power," said Carter. "And that's me right now. Of course, you could turn a couple of runners up to the ball, but I don't reckon that'd be a good career move. So what I'm asking is for your men to assist us with a little surgical strike." The Major stared at him. There was now no limit to the distaste he had for Carter. But he hadn't been a major for very long, and when you've just been promoted, you hope to stay that way long enough for the braid to get a tarnish. He forced himself to smile. "You and your men have had a long day, Sergeant," he said. "Why don't you go along to the mess tent while I consult with my fellow officers?" Carter stood up with a suddenness that made the major flinch, then leaned forward with his knuckles on the desk.
"You do that, Sonny Jim," he said, with a grin like the edge of a rusty saw. Then he turned and strode out into the night.
In the silence that followed, Wrangle said, "His name is on the list of officers that Swing sent us yesterday, I'm afraid. And he's technically correct about the law."
"You mean we have to take orders from him?"
"No, but he's entitled to request assistance from you."
"Am I entitled to refuse?"
"Oh, yes, of course, but..."
"I'd have to tell his lordship why."
"Exactly."
"But that man's an evil bastard. You know the sort, the kind that joins up for the pillaging, the kind you have to end up hanging as an example to the men." "What now?"
"Well, he's right about one thing. I've been looking at the reports, and, well, it's odd. It's all been very quiet down towards Treacle Mine Road."
"That's good, isn't it?"
"It's unbelievable, Clive, when you put it all together. Even the watch house didn't get attacked, it says here. And your Captain Burns says he met this Keel chap, or someone who said he was Keel, and he says that if the man's a watch sergeant, then he, Burns, is a monkey's uncle. He says the man is used to serious command. I think he rather took to him, to tell you the truth."
"Hey, gods, Tom, I need some help here," said the Major.
"Then send out some gallopers right away. A little informal patrolling, perhaps. Get some proper intelligence. You can afford to wait half an hour."
"Right, right, good idea," said the Major, steaming with relief. "See to it, could you?"
After the flurry of orders, he sat back and stared at the map. Some things at least made sense. All these barricades looked inward. People were barricading themselves against the palace and the centre of the city. No one would be bothered much about the outside world. If you had to take an outlying part of the city in those circumstances, then the thing to do would be to go in via a gatehouse in the city wall. They might not be quite so guarded as they ought to be.
"Tom?"
"Yes, Clive?"
"Have you ever sung the national anthem?"
"Oh, lots of times, sir."
"I don't mean officially."
"You mean... just to show I'm patriotic? Good gods, no. That'll be rather an odd thing to do," said the captain.
"And how about the flag?"
"Well, obviously I salute it every day, sir."
"But you don't wave it at all?" the Major inquired.
"I think I waved a paper one a few times when I was a little boy. Patrician's birthday or something. We stood in the streets as he rode by and we shouted, hurrah."
"Never since then?"
"Well, no, Clive," said the captain, looking embarrassed. "I'd be very worried if I saw a man singing the national anthem and waving the flag, sir. It's really a thing foreigners do."
"Really? Why?"
"We don't need to show we're patriotic, sir. I mean, this is Ankh-Morpork. We don't have to make a big fuss about being the best, sir. We just know." It was a beguiling theory that might have arisen in the minds of Wiglet and Waddy and, yes, even in the not overly exercised mind of Fred Colon, and as far as Vimes could understand it, it went like this. 1. Supposing the area behind the barricades was bigger than the area in front of the barricades, right? 2. Like, sort of, it had more people in it and more of the city, if you follow me. 3. Then, correct me if I'm wrong, Sarge, but that'd mean, in a manner of speaking, we are now in front of the barricades, am I right? 4. Then, as it were, it's not like we're rebelling, is it? 'Cause there's more of us... so the majority can't rebel, it stands to reason. 5. So that makes us the good guys. Obviously, we've been the good guys all along, but now it'd be kind of official, right? Like, mathematical. 6. So we thought we'd push on to Short Street, and then we could nip down into Dimwell and up the other side of the river. 7. Are we going to get in trouble for this, Sarge? 8. You're looking at me in a funny way, Sarge. 9. Sorry, Sarge.
Vimes, with an increasingly worried Fred Colon in front of him, and some of the other barricadiers standing around as if caught in an illicit game of knocking on doors and running away, thought about this. The men watched him carefully in case of explosion. And it actually made a weird kind of logic, if you didn't factor in considerations like real life and common sense. They'd worked hard. It was easy enough to block a city street, heavens knew. You just nailed planks around a couple of wagons and piled it high with furniture and junk. That took care of the main streets. And with enough pushing, you could move it forwards. As for the rest, it really hadn't been that hard. There had been lots of small barricades in any case. The lads had simply joined them up, without anyone really noticing. The People's Republic of Treacle Mine Road now occupied almost a quarter of the city. Vimes took a few deep breaths. "Fred," he said.
"Yes, Sarge."
"Did I tell you to do this?"
"No, Sarge."
"There's too many alleys. There's too many people, Fred." Colon brightened.
"Oh, well, there's more coppers too, Sarge. A lot of the lads found their way here. Good lads, too. And Sergeant Dickens, he knows about this stuff. He remembers the last time this happened, Sarge. So he asked every able-bodied man who knew how to use a weapon to muster up, Sarge. There's a lot of them, Sarge. We got an army, Sarge."
"This is how the world collapses," thought Vimes. "I was just a young fool. I didn't see it like this. I thought Keel was leading a revolution. I wonder if that's what he thought, too. But I just wanted to keep a few streets safe. I just wanted to keep a handful of decent, silly people away from the dumb mobs and the mindless rebels and the idiot soldiery. I really, really hoped we could get away with it." Maybe the monks were right. Changing history is like damming a river. It'll find its way around. He saw Sam beaming among the men. Hero worship, he thought. That sort of thing can turn you blind. "Any trouble?" he said.
"Don't think anyone's worked out what's happening here, Sarge. There's been a lot happening round Dolly Sisters and over that way. Cavalry charges and what have you. Hold on, here comes some more."
A watchman had signalled from the top of the barricade. Vimes heard the commotion on the other side of the pile.
"More people running away from Dolly Sisters by the look of it," said Colon. "What do you want us to do, Sarge?"
"Keep them out," thought Vimes. "We don't know who they are. We can't let everyone in. Some of them will be trouble. The trouble is, I know what's going on out there. The city is a little slice of hell, and there's no real safety anywhere. And I know what I'm going to decide, because I watch me decide it. I don't believe this. I'm standing over there now, a kid who's still clean and pink and full of ideals, looking at me as if I'm some kind of hero. I don't dare not be. I'm going to make the stupid decision, because I don't want to look bad in front of myself. Try explaining that to anyone who hasn't had a couple of drinks."
"All right, let them through," he said. "But no weapons. Pass the word round."
"Take weapons off, people," said Colon.
"Think about it, Fred. We don't want unmentionables in here, do we? Or soldiers in disguise. A man's got to be vouched for before he can carry arms. I ain't going to be stabbed in the back and the front at the same time. Oh, and Fred. I don't know if I can do this. Probably it won't last. But as far as I'm concerned, you're promoted as sergeant. Anyone who wants to argue about the extra stripe, tell him to argue with me."
Fred Colon's chest, already running to fat, swelled visibly.
"Right, Sarge. Does that mean I still take orders from you?"
Right. I still take orders from you, right."
"Don't move any more barricades. Fill up the alleys. Hold this line. Vimes, you come with me. I'll need a runner."
"I'm pretty runny, Sarge,"
Nobby volunteered from somewhere behind him.
"Then what I want you to do, Nobby, is get out there and find out what's happening now."
Sergeant Dickens turned out to be younger than Vimes remembered, but he was still close to retirement. He'd maintained a flourishing sergeant's moustache, waxed to points and clearly dyed, and the proper sergeant shape, occasioned by means of undisclosed corsetry. He'd spent a lot of time in the regiments, Vimes recalled, although he came from Llamidos originally. The men found that out because he belonged to some druid religion so strict that they didn't even use standing stones, and they were strongly against swearing, which is a real handicap in a sergeant. Or would be, if sergeants weren't so good at improvising. He was currently in Welcome Soap, a continuation of Cable Street. And he had the army. It wasn't much of one. No two weapons were exactly alike, and most of them were not, strictly speaking, weapons. Vimes shuddered when he saw the crowd and had a flashback, which was probably a flash forward, to all the domestic disputes he'd attended over the years. You knew where you were with strictly speaking weapons when they came at you. It was the not-strictly-speaking ones that scared the khaki out of a new recruit. It was the meat cleavers tied to poles. It was the long spikes and the meat hooks. This was, after all, the area of small traders, porters, butchers and longshoremen. And so standing in raggedy lines in front of Vimes were men who, every day, peacefully and legally, handled things with blades and spikes that made a mere sword look like a girl's hatpin. There were classic weapons, too. Men had come back from wars with their sword or their halberd. "Weapons? God bless you, sir, no, them's mementos!" And the sword had probably been used to poke the fire, and the halberd had done duty as a support for one end of the washing line, and their original use had been forgotten. Until now. Vimes stared at the metalwork. All this lot would have to do to win a battle would be to stand still. If the enemy charged them hard enough, he'd come out the other side as mince.
"Some of them are retired watchmen, sir," Dickens whispered. "A lot of them have been in the regiments at one time or another, see? There's a few kids wanting to see some action, you know how it is. What do you think?"
"I'd certainly hate to fight them," said Vimes. At least a quarter of the men had white hair, and more than a few were using their weapons as a means of support. "Come to that, I'd hate to be responsible for giving them an order. If I said about turn to this lot, it'd be raining limbs."
"They're resolute, sir."
"Fair enough, but I don't want a war."
"Oh, it won't come to that, sir," said Dickens. "I've seen a few barricades in my time. It generally ends peaceful. The new man takes over, people get bored, everyone goes home, see."
"But Winder is a nutter," said Vimes.
"Tell me one that wasn't, sir," said Dickens.
"Sir," thought Vimes.
"Or sir, at least.
And he's older than me. Oh, well. I might as well be good at it." "Sergeant," he said, "I want you to pick 20 of the best. Men that have seen action. Men you can trust. And I want them down at Shambling Gate and alert."
Dickens looked puzzled. "But that's bad, sir. And it's right down behind us, it is. I thought maybe..."
"Down at the gate, sergeant," Vimes insisted. "They're to watch for anyone sneaking up to unbar it. And I want the guard on the bridges to be strengthened. Put down caltrops on the bridge. String wires. I want anyone who tries to come at us over the bridge to have a really bad time. Understand?"
"Do you know something, sir?" said Dickens, with his head on one side.
"Let's just say I'm thinking like the enemy, shall we?" said Vimes. He took a step closer and lowered his voice. "You know some mystery, Di. No one with an ounce of sense goes up against a barricade. You find the weakness."
"There's other gates down there, sir," said Dickens doubtfully.
"Yes. But if they take Shambling, they get into Elm Street and have a nice long gallop, right into where we're not expecting them," said Vimes.
"But you are expecting them, sir."
Vimes just gave him a blank look, which sergeants are quite good at deciphering.
"As good as done, sir," said Dickens happily.
"But I want a decent presence at all the barricades," said Vimes, "and a couple of patrols that can go wherever there's trouble. Sergeant, you know how to do it."
"Right, sir."
Dickens saluted smartly and grinned. He turned to the assembled citizenry.
"All right, you shower," he yelled. "Some of you has been in a regiment, I know it. How many of you knows all the little angels?"
A few of the more serious class of mementos rose in the air.
"Very good. Already we has a choir. Now this is a soldier's song, see? You don't look like soldiers, but by the gods I'll see you sounds like 'em. You'll pick it up as we goes along. Right turn. March. All the little angels, rise up, rise up. All the little angels, rise up high. Sing it, you songs of mothers."
The marchers picked up the response from those who knew it. "How do they rise up, rise up, rise up? How do they rise up high?
Rise, heads up, heads up, heads up," sang out Dickens as they turned the corner.
Vimes listened as the refrain died away. "That's a nice song," said young Sam, and Vimes realised that he was hearing it for the first time.
"It's an old soldier's song," he said.
"Really, Sarge? But it's about angels."
"Yes," thought Vimes, "and it's amazing what bits those angels caused to rise up as the song progresses. It's a real soldier's song, sentimental, with dirty bits."
"As I recall, they used to sing it after battles," he said. "I've seen old men cry when they sing it," he added.
"Why? It sounds cheerful."
They were remembering who they were not singing it with, thought Vimes. "You'll learn. I know you will." After a while, the patrols came back. Major Mountjoy Standfast was bright enough not to ask for written reports. They took too long and weren't very well spelled. One by one, the men told the story. Sometimes Captain Wrangle, who was plotting things on the map, would whistle under his breath.
"It's huge, sir. It really is. Nearly a quarter of the city's behind the barricades down there."
The Major rubbed his forehead and turned to Trooper Gabitas, the last man in and the one who seemed to have taken pains to get the most information.
"They're all on a sort of line, sir, so I rode up to the one on Hero Street with me helmet off and looking off duty, sort of thing, and asked what it was all about. A man shouted down that everything was all right, thank you very much, and they'd finished all the barricades for now. I said, what about law and order? And they said, we've got plenty, thank you.
No one fired at you?
No, sir. Wish I could say the same about around here. People were throwing stones at me, and an old lady emptied a utensil all over me from her window. There's something else, sir.
Out with it, man.
I think I recognised a few people up on barricades. They were some of ours, sir.
Vimes shut his eyes, in the hope that the world would be a better place. But when he opened them, it was still full of the pink face of only just Sergeant Colon.
Fred, he said, I wonder if you fully understand the basic idea here. The soldiers, that's the other people, Fred, they stay on the outside of the barricade. If they are on the inside, Fred, we don't, in any real sense, have a bloody barricade. Do you understand?
Yes, sir, but...
You want to do a spell in the regiment, Fred, and one of the things I think you'll find they're very hot on indeed is knowing who's on your side and who is not, Fred.
But, sir, they are...
I mean, how long have I known you, Fred?
2 or 3 days, sir.
Right, yeah, of course. Seems longer. So why, Fred, do I arrive here and find you've let in what seems like a platoon? You haven't been thinking metaphysically again, have you?
It started with Billy Wiglet's brother, sir, said Colon nervously. A few of his mates came with him. All local lads. And there's a lad Nancy Ball grew up with and a bloke who's the son of Waddy's next-door neighbour who we used to go out drinking with. And then there's...
How many, Fred? Said Vimes wearily.
60, sir. Might be a few more by now.
And it doesn't occur to you that they might be part of some clever plan?
No, Sarge, it never did, because I can't see Wally Wiglet being part of a clever plan, Sarge, on account of him not being much of a thinker, sir. They only allowed him to be in the regiment after he got someone to paint L and R on his boots. See, we know them all, Sarge. Most of the lads join up for a bit, just to get out of the city and maybe show Johnny Foreigner who's boss. They never expected to have old grannies spitting on them in their own city, Sarge. That can get a lad down, that sort of thing. And getting cobblestones chucked at them too, of course.
Vimes gave in.
It was all true.
All right, he said. But if this goes on, everyone is going to be inside the barricade, Fred.
And there could be worse ways of ending it, he thought. People had lit fires in the streets. Some cooking pots had been brought out. But most of the people were engaging in Ankh Morpork's traditional pastime, which was hanging around to see what would happen next.
"What's going to happen next, Sarge?" said Sam.
"I think they'll attack in two places," said Vimes. "The cavalry will go right outside the city and try to come in through the Shambling Gate, because that'll look easy. And the soldiers and the rest of the watch who aren't on our side will probably creep across Misbegot Bridge under cover."
"Are you sure, sir?"
"Positive," said Vimes. After all, it had already happened. Or something.
He pinched the bridge of his nose. He couldn't quite remember when he'd slept last. Slept, not dozed or been unconscious. He knew his thinking was a little fuzzy around the edges, but he didn't know how the Treacle Mine Road barricade had been broken. It had been only one sentence in the history book, but he remembered it. Sieges that weren't broken via treachery were breached via some small door around the back. It was a fact of history.
"But it won't be for an hour or two," he said aloud. "We're not important enough. It's all been quiet down here. It's when they start to wonder why that the midden will hit the windmill."
"Lots of people are getting through, Sarge. Some of the men said they could hear screaming in the distance. People are just piling in. There's robberies and everything going on out there."
"Lance Constable?"
"Yes, Sarge."
"You know when you wanted to swing a club at that torturing bastard and I stopped you?"
"Yes, Sarge."
"That's why, lad. Once we break down, it all breaks down."
"Yes, Sarge, but you do bop people over the head."
"Interesting point, Lance Constable. Logical and well-made too, in a clear tone of voice bordering on the bloody cheeky. But there's a big difference."
"And what's that, Sarge?"
"You'll find out," said Vimes. And privately thought, "The answer is, it's me doing it. I'll grant that it's not a good answer, because people like Carsey use it too. But that's what it boils down to. Of course, it's also to stop me knifing them, and, let's be frank, them knifing me.
That's quite important, too. Their walk had brought them to a big fire in the centre of the street. A cauldron was bubbling on it, and people were queuing up, holding bowls. "Smells good," he said, to the figure gently stirring the cauldron's contents with a ladle.
"Oh, it's you, Mr. Dibbler."
"It's called Victory Stew, Sergeant," said Dibbler. "Tuppence a bowl or I'll cut my throat, eh?"
"Close enough," said Vimes,
and looked at the strange, and what was worse, occasionally hauntingly familiar, lumps seething in the scum.
"What's in it?"
"It's stew," explained Dibbler.
"Strong enough to put hairs on your chest."
"Yes, I can see that some of those bits of meat have got bristles on them already," said Vimes.
"Right, that's how good it is."
"It looks very nice," said Sam weakly.
"You'll have to excuse the Lance Constable, Mr. Dibbler," said Vimes. "The poor lad was brought up not to eat stew that winks at him."
He sat down with his bowl and his back against the wall and looked up at the barricade. People had been busy. In truth, there wasn't much else to do. The one here, from side to side of Hero Street, was 14 feet high and even had a crude walkway. It looked businesslike. He leaned back and shut his eyes. There was a hesitant slurping sound beside him as young Sam tried the stew, and then...
"Is it going to come down to fighting, Sarge?"
"Yes," said Vimes without opening his eyes.
"Like... really fighting?"
"Yep."
"But won't there be some talking first?"
"No," said Vimes, trying to make himself comfortable. "Maybe some talking afterwards."
"Seems the wrong way round."
"Yes, lad, but it's a tried and tested method." There was no further comment. Slowly, with the sounds of the street in his ears, Vimes slid into sleep. Major Mountjoy Standfast knew what would happen if he sent a message to the palace. "What do I do now, sir?" was not something his lordship wanted to hear. It was not the sort of question a major was supposed to ask, given that the original orders had been very clear. Barricades were to be torn down, rebels were to be repelled, grasp the nettle firmly and all that. He had, as a child, grasped nettles firmly, and had sometimes had a hand the size of a small pig. There were deserters behind the barricade. Deserters? How did that happen? It was a huge barricade. It was lined with armed men. There were deserters on it, and he had his orders. It was all clear. If only they'd... well, rebel. He'd sent Trooper Gabitas down there again, and by his account it seemed very peaceful. Normal city life appeared to be going on behind the barricade, which was more than you could say for the chaos outside it. If they'd fired on Gabitas or thrown things, that would have made it so much easier. Instead, they were acting, well, decently. That was no way for enemies of the state to behave. An enemy of the state was in front of the Major now. Gabitas had not come back empty-handed.
"Caught it sneaking after me," he said. To the captive, he said, "Been behind the barricade, haven't we, my lad?" "Can it speak?" said the Major, staring at the thing.
"There's no need to be like that," said Nobby Nobbs.
"It's a street urchin, sir," said the trooper.
The Major stared at all he could see of the prisoner, which was an oversized helmet and a nose.
"Get it something to stand on, will you, Captain?" he said,
and waited while a stool was found. It did not, all things considered, improve matters. It just gave rise to questions.
"It's got a watch badge, trooper. Is it some kind of mascot?"
"Carved it myself out of soap," said Nobby, "so I can be a copper."
"Why?" said the Major.
There was something about the apparition that, despite the urgency, called for a kind of horrified yet fascinated study.
"But I'm thinking of going on for a soldier if I grow up," Nobby went on, giving the Major a happy grin. "Much better pickings, the way things are going."
"I'm afraid you're not tall enough," said the Major quickly.
"Don't see why not. The enemy reaches all the way to the ground," said Nobby. "Anyway, people are lying down when you get their boots off. Old Sconner, he says the money's in teeth and earrings, but I say every man's bound to have a pair of boots, right? Whereas there's a lot of bad teeth around these days, and the false teeth makers always demand a decent set."
"Do you mean to tell me that you want to join the army just to loot the battlefields?" said the Major, completely shocked. "A little lad like you?"
"Once, when old Sconner was sober for 2 days together, he made me a little set of soldiers," said Nobby, "and he had these little boots that you could..."
"Shut up," said the Major.
"Take off, and tiny little wooden teeth that you could..."
"Will you shut up?"
said the Major.
Have you no interest in honour, glory, love of city?
Dunno. Can you get much for 'em? Said Nobby.
They are priceless.
Oh, well, in that case I'll stick with the boots if it's all the same to you, said Nobby. You can sell 'em for 10 pence a pair if you know the right shop.
Look at Trooper Gabbitas there, said the Major, now quite upset. 20 years' service, a fine figure of a soldier. He wouldn't stoop to stealing the boots of a fallen enemy, would you, Trooper? No, sir. Mug's game, sir, said Trooper Gabbitas.
And this was true. Don't bother with the boots would have been Trooper Gabbitas's advice, had he been inclined to part with it. You need to bribe someone on the baggage carts to build up stock, and when all's said and done, you'll only make a few dollars. Stick to jewellery. It's portable. Trooper Gabbitas had seen too many battlefields up close to use the word glory without wincing.